It's Monday morning, the Paris podcast. Oh, I hear a car outside going beep beep.
It sounded so French.
Beep. Well, the espresso machine broke down at the cafe this morning.
Oh my god, then why are you so wired?
Well, they were cooking up some coffee in the kitchen.
Oh, that's cool.
What they call coffee American.
Mmm.
Which is not espresso, it's filtered, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And what else was happening at the cafe this morning? Not much, except that the Liberation newspaper, which was the paper started by Jean-Paul Sartre.
Oh, hey.
Looks like it's on its last legs. It's going out of business, going bankrupt.
No.
There's an emergency plan to bail it out on September 27th.
Huh.
One of the Rothschild family is putting together something, possibly, but it doesn't look good. So it could be that Liberation, the paper of the extreme left, is going out of business.
Oh, my God. That's a shock.
Well, yeah. What's even more shocking is that recently, over the past few years, they've really not stuck to the left perspective. They have gone, actually, center right.
Oh, okay. Well, so, let them go. Let them eat cake, then. I see the center right party won in Sweden last night.
Is that right? Sweden's gone fundamentalist?
What? The guy who won... just by a tiny margin, another 51% miracle voting machine situation, by the way.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he was running on a Blairite sort of campaign.
Right.
And I guess there are enough Swedes that want to get rid of their social model.
Yeah, they want to do more of the privatization stuff. Selling off state assets.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess if you don't mind the whole vomiting violence on the street that London has, or the gunning down your schoolmates as America has, then if you're willing to accept that risk,
yeah,
then I guess fine, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's countries like Sweden and France too, you know, they don't really know what they're getting into when they get into this whole privatization scheme. They think that they can control it. They say, we can do it better. We can do it better than Britain. We can do it better, America. We can sell off our state assets and replace the equity with debt. And give top-up fees to our kids and destroy our health care and transportation system and everything like that. And, you know, we can control it. We can do a better job. And, of course, it's a slippery slope because it brings in the contractors who do the work, end up in politics, they end up in the media, and then you end up with fascism like you have in America today.
Or is this just a case of this baby boom generation who are like the greediest bastards? So they wanted the perfect social welfare state while they were growing up and while they were going to university and while they were using the healthcare system. And then as soon as they're nearing retirement age, they're like, we don't want to pay for the education system for all these young people.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems to be what's driving it in the UK as well.
Yeah, they're greedy. The people who are retiring now, they don't want the next generation to have any, you know, they don't want to pay, as you say, for the next generation's education or health care or anything like that. They just want to cut them off.
Mm-hmm.
They want to cut them off, and they want to apply a tourniquet to the next generation and cut them off from the blood supply of civilization. And the next generation, as we have the case in Japan, are blowing their brains out.
Exactly. Well, this is a story out of the UK, and it's really quite shocking, okay? 27% of those aged 65 and over said they are racking up debt with no intention of paying it off. 27% of those aged over 65 with debt said they had no intention of clearing it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the government is starting to get alarmed by this because the UK's mounting debt crisis is starting to dent their own finances. So they may take action. They may be forced to consider moving towards a system more akin to that of Japan, where debt is passed on to children on the death of a parent.
Right.
Can you imagine that?
Well, I can because I listen to this show. Okay, we've been doing the show for 3 years, and we've been telling people about this, that intergenerational debt will become a reality in the UK and in the US.
The story in Reuters goes on to say that, indeed, we are seeing moves in this direction already with the introduction of the deathbed mortgage. It's a new mortgage that allows homeowners to pass on their mortgage debt when they die and potentially cut any inheritance tax on the bill. They're calling it an intergenerational mortgage.
Yeah. 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 Well, you know, where have we seen this before? Back in the Middle Ages.
Exactly. Well, that's what tax experts warn, is that this is an absurd mortgage because Switzerland and Japan have this already.
Mm-hmm.
But it means paying a huge amount of mortgage interest without ever owning the property.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these mortgages are interest-only mortgage.
Yeah.
Where you're not paying down any of the principal. You're not taking ownership. You're just paying interest.
They're doing this in order to avoid paying inheritance taxes to society, to the government. And instead, they're paying interest charges. They'd rather pay a banker than the government.
In a small minority of cases where the mortgage is at a fixed rate, at a very low interest rate, this might be a benefit. But in the vast majority of mortgages that have been written, it's not a benefit. It's horrible because you're passing this huge interest rate expenses on to the next generation. And the fact is this, my friends, that the legal system will kick in and this will be the law of the land, that it'll be impossible to simply rack up debts and then die, as we're seeing. What was the number? A quarter of all the people die with huge mortgages and debts on the books?
And they have no intention of clearing it. 27%.
No, I mean, they intend to clear it in the afterworld. That's their intention. But this can't possibly go on, and the banking system is completely dependent on writing debts, and so this is obviously, we're going to go down the path of Japan, is have these intergenerational debts pass from one economy to another. And of course, the legal framework in Japan and the U.S. and Britain are all tied together through the banking system, which are all tied together: Sumitomo Bank, Bank of America, Bank of Japan, Federal Reserve Bank, Bank of England. So this is what. So what? Not unsurprisingly, we have in Japan, the youth is, of course, getting online, creating little clubs, getting together in like a MySpace. It's a MySpace for suicide.
Well, you know, this generation, our generation behind this baby boomer generation, is already inheriting their ecological debts.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're being handed their financial debts.
Well, we're being, you know, this next generation is inheriting the ecological debts. They're inheriting the state debts.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, the U.S. economy is, they raise a debt ceiling to $9 trillion. It's got $70 trillion in unfunded pensions. It's got $3 or $4 trillion just basically in garden variety debt.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, you will add this family debt, individual debt. So you've got, you got three major, a trifecta of indebtedness: eco debt, state debt, individual debt. All being passed on to the next generation. And this next generation is diving into the internet in many cases, living online in a virtual world to escape the fact that they're being set up for mass debt slaughter, you know, or they're taking another route, which is they're strapping some C4 onto their chest and going onto a bus and blowing some, you know. Why? Because this so-called greatest generation, World War II generation, is the worst generation, if you want to look at it in terms of the risk that they've posed to the generations that follow. No generation in the history of all humanity, going back to when Org first threw a rock at Eve, no one has left so much debt.
No, and then this out from the UK this past weekend: graduates in their 20s and early 30s face a grim struggle over the next decade to make ends meet, a report warns today. Rising taxes, student debt repayments, and pension contributions means that they will soon be handing over almost half of their income to the state, let alone their parents' debts. Now they're about to be told, oh, you're actually also going to be hand your parents' debt, suckers.
Well, I saw the story of the weekend where the CCTV cameras in the UK are now fitted out with speakers.
Yep.
So the people down at the Mission Control Center who are watching all these CCTV cameras, who are watching feral youth on, you know, some corner of the estate, council estate, will when the poor schlub is tossing a cigarette into the trash bin or getting into a fight, then they hear over the speakers, "Hey, you there in the hoodie, clean up after that mess, break up that fight.
We're watching you. We're watching you."
Right. Well, I mean, the next step is you're going to feed into the computer everyone who's got these massive debts. And anytime you step out on the street, the speaker will say, "Hey, you there in the striped shirt, when are you going to pay us back the money you owe us?" You're going to be harassed to death. You're going to be henpecked to death. It's called slavery. Hello, slavery. Hello, slavery. Hello, slavery. You know, but
yep. Well,
hate to see it happen. But then again, I'm glad it's not me.
Well, exactly. This is the report about this growing mountain of debt on the iPod generation, who they call insecure, pressurized, overtaxed, and debt-ridden. That's the name of the report.
Mm-hmm.
This group, Reform, who did this report, said that it's gotten worse in the last 12 months, because in the past 12 months, the Blair government has cut the state pension, meaning that these iPod generation who are already insecure, overtaxed, and debt-ridden are going to have to pay even more of their pensions.
Look, the at some point, those with the money to do so are going to create fortresses.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to retire into these fortresses.
Yep.
And they're going to leave everyone else out there in the wilderness to survive amongst themselves. And it's not going to be pretty, because the environment will be completely toxic. There'll be tons of guns, tons of knives. And there'll be no law at all. And it'll be savagery. And meanwhile, those who can will be living underground or in fortresses or in castles surrounded by moats. And this will be around the world, various castles. And, you know, it's pre-feudalism. I mean, feudalism had chivalry. It had the knights. And, you know, it had some elements of what you could call, civilization. This is going back. This is probably never in the history of human experience. You're going to have humans, such a large proportion of humans, living chest deep in muck.
Well, on this sort of topic, Gary Young in The Guardian wrote an interesting commentary today. You know, he's the Guardian journalist. He's a black guy. He lives in America, though, and he writes about American
issues.
He's
my brother, man.
Yeah. And he wrote a story today, a commentary today, "What's the Matter with Voting Republican If You're Poor?" And it's a really interesting take on this whole, on that book, you know, "What's the Matter with Kansas?" and how these poor people are voting for people like Bush. So Gary Young goes on to point out that according to recent U.S. Census figures, since President Bush assumed power in 2000, poverty in the United States has risen by 7%. The proportion of those without health care has risen by 9%. And median household income has fallen by 3%.
Mm-hmm.
But where poor are the most numerous, it seems the Democrats are weakest. But he really
The what?
The states that were the poorest, that's where the Democrats did the least well in the 2004 elections.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, the states with the five fastest growing rates of poverty,
mm,
those all went Republican in 2004. And in fact, the same census figures show that 7 of the 10 states with the highest median incomes voted Democrat. And citizens who lived in Democrat states were less likely to live in poverty and more likely to have health insurance. And these states are getting wealthier. In fact, the 5 with the sharpest increase in income all voted Democrat in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
But what he found is, like, everybody then assumed, they make that assumption that the poor are voting against their own economic self-interest, and that's why they voted for Republican, blah, blah, blah. But he says, no. What has happened is that the poor are not voting as much as the rich. In fact, anybody making over $100,000, the turnout in 2004 was 81%. To vote.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the figure for those who earned less than $20,000 was 48%. So it was the rich people in the poorer states with more poverty around them that hated the poor more and voted for policies that were against the people around them. But it was also very much a racist thing. He traces it all to a lot of the South is still paying for Lyndon Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act.
Right.
They just will not vote Democrat because of that.
Yeah, a lot of people around the world don't know or don't realize how entrenched racism is in America and how it still shapes policies.
He's saying that indeed, were it not for black people, the Democrats would have won only once in 1964. That was the year President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, turned to an aide and said, quote, "We have lost the South for a generation," end quote.
Mm-hmm.
Then Gary Young goes on to say, "We are well into the second generation now, and the racialized politics of the South seem to be influencing the rest of the country rather than the other way around." So Lyndon Johnson thought that the Civil Rights Act was only going to lose the South for one generation, and then people would forget and have become more egalitarian and accepting of the blacks in the community. But in fact, their racism is influencing more of the entire nation.
Right. Well, that's a recurring theme on this show.
Yeah.
That America is deeply racist. The reason they don't want universal health care in America is because the poor white people would rather kill themselves than to see poor black people get health care.
Exactly.
Because it's deeply rooted in a deep, deep racist streak running through America. It's been really the defining. It's why America ultimately is going to fail. Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War tried to rectify this problem. They failed. Lyndon Johnson tried to rectify this problem. He failed. We are now in 2006. Racism is dividing and polarizing America. That's the root of the so-called evangelical movement. It's because white people down South hate black people. It's not that they love God. It's that they hate black people. That's what informs the American evangelical movement, racism. You know, Billy Graham is a racist. Jerry Falwell is a racist. You know, why are all these white guys stealing baptism from the black people for another one? Evangelicalism comes out of the black church. Now it's all white? I'm going to sneeze.
You know, who predicted this, of course, was Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote about democracy in America from 1820 to 1840. He traveled across America. Yeah. And he said the one thing he saw for the future, what would take down democracy in America was the black man. He saw no way that they would ever be able to reconcile the black person into their society.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty obvious, you know, that racism is really the cancer that continuing to divide the U.S. And racism, and you have, of course, Bush, who is he's a honky, isn't he? He's a honky bitch. And he's got contempt for the black man.
Yeah.
That's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
And he's taken this racist streak. I mean, if you look at Bush's speeches, and you compare them, let's say, to Medgar Evers, who was on trial for killing a black man, slaughtering a black man. The smirks, the sideways glances, rolling the eyes, that whole act that one does when you're white and racist and having just killed or lynched a black man. You put on a little act, don't you? Well, like, I got away with it.
Medgar Evers was the guy killed.
Oh, shit. I forgot.
He was the black man. I don't know who killed him. I'll find that out while you talk. But he was the famous black civil rights activist.
So Medgar Evers is the victim.
Yes.
The white guy who was his assailant. Who there was a movie made about this not too long ago. Of course, the whole act that these supremacists and white supremacists put on, the Ku Klux Klan members, the white supremacists in America, when they're on trial, they know that the jury's white and the judge is white and the community's white, and they're not going to be taken to, you know, put in jail for being homicide, for killing somebody. So they put on that whole act. So now when Bush does his press conferences, up until recently now, he's actually entered a new stage. But up until recently, he always put on that act like, well, I'm white. The Supreme Court is white, including Clarence Thomas. And the community who votes for me is white. The corporations are white. What do you think y'all going to do? You know, ha, ha, ha. You know, you thought you had civil rights. You thought you had human rights. The joke's on you. Ha, ha, ha. And he's just like watching these old civil rights trials where the white guys are on trial for lynching the black people. And there was no hope of getting a conviction because it's a rigged jury. It's a rigged market. And racism is at the core of it. And so when Bush goes into Iraq, he thinks he has impunity to slaughter 100,000 Iraqis, innocents, civilians, because after all, they're not white, are they? So back home, back south, he's like, yeah, yeah, we're going to kill them black people in Iraq. Did you ever find the victim's name?
The victim's name is Medgar Evers.
Did you ever find the assailant's name?
The assailant's name is Byron De La Beckwith.
Oh, that's right. Byron De La Beckwith. I believe it was played by James Woods in the movie version.
I didn't
Made up
the
to
movie.
Appear to be like 75 years old.
Yes, he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and he was tried for murder on two occasions, both resulting in a hung jury. However, he was finally sentenced to life in prison in 1994.
Right.
De La Beckwith openly mocked the law enforcement for not being able to convict him for over 25 years. Then finally, in 1989, a reporter ran across records that revealed that a secret background check had been done on the jurors in the first two trials. So they voided those first two trials, so it wasn't that double jeopardy thing. And then Assistant District Attorney Bobby DeLaughter finally got new evidence.
Played by Alec Baldwin.
Well, I'm just laughing at these names. Byron De La Beckwith and Bobby DeLaughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. The gun actually had Beckwith's fingerprints on it, but like, for some reason that was not introduced as evidence in the first two trials.
Right. So what you just read, he was joking about it for 20 years, mocking about it. Like, you can't get me. I killed them black people. You can't get me in jail because I'm white.
Exactly.
You know, this is Bush's smirking. Like, you can't get me. I'm white. Can't get me. But now, of course, the U.S. is into a new phase because, Bush has alienated a lot of these Republicans who don't cotton to the neocon way of doing things. So there's a bit of a problem over there. So I'm looking at this editorial here in today's International Herald Tribune.
Oh, what does it say, honey? Who wrote it?
Huh?
Who wrote it?
The editorial staff of the International Herald Tribune.
Oh,
that's why it's called an editorial. It says, "Killing Off America's Future" is the name of this one. America's domination of the global information economy flowed directly from policies that allowed the largest generation in the nation's history broad access to first-rate college education. By subsidizing public universities to keep tuition low and providing federal tuition aid to poor and working-class students, the country vaulted tens of millions of people into the middle class while building the best educated workforce in the world. Those far-sighted policies, however, are a thing of the past. Cuts in college aid, soaring tuition, state colleges have made it difficult for young people to educate themselves. The warning about American vulnerability has underscored yet again in a study of the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, a nonpartisan research organization. The report highlights some ominous trends. As the boomers march off into retirement, the generation that replaces them is shaping up to be less educated by far. No longer the world leader in terms of the proportion of young people enrolled in college, America now ranks 16th among the 27 nations examined when it comes to the proportion of college students who complete college degrees to certificate programs. When judged in terms of college affordability, 43 American states are given Fs in their new report. The states and the college themselves have shifted aid, once aimed at the poor students, to the middle and upper income levels. Oh, I get it. So it's socialism for the rich again.
Uh-huh.
Unless we Americans renew our commitment to higher education policies, we could soon find ourselves at the mercy of an increasingly competitive global economy. What do you mean, may soon find ourselves at the mercy? That's a well past that point. You're getting your ass kicked. May soon find themselves at the mercy. What?
Well, they have to put a positive spin on it, don't they? Otherwise, they get attacked by the Bush administration.
they may soon find themselves. Oh, my God. Here's one. Bush untethered. Watching President George Bush on Friday in the Rose Garden as he threatened to quit interrogating terrorists. Now, what was I talking about last show or the show before that? Remember I said that America was pulling out of all these programs, so the world should pull out of some program?
Yes, you said that yesterday.
What did I say?
You said that Hugo Chavez should pull out of the TRIPS copyright cartel program because Bush has dropped out of Kyoto. He's dropped out of, you know, reasoning, education system. He's just dropped out of the world courts, you know, the world Geneva conventions. He's just dropped out of those.
So, yeah, I want to reemphasize that.
Okay, go ahead.
Hugo Chavez should drop out of the TRIPS copyright, global copyright level. I want to reemphasize that. Hugo Chavez should pull out of TRIPS, which is the global copyright system.
Mm-hmm.
Because copyright system is a tool of slavery.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
And Hugo Chavez, he's on a roll. Everyone in Latin America, Bolivia, Chile, Mexico, everybody. Everyone should pull out of TRIPS. TRIPS is bad. TRIPS is bad. So anyway, Harold should be in here talking about Bush untethered, blah, blah, blah. Watching President George Bush on Friday in the Rose Garden as he threatened to quit interrogating terrorists if Congress did not approve his detainee bill. Oh, yeah, listen to this. This is a good one, Stacey.
Okay,
we were struck by how often his acts is as though they were not two sides to a debate. We have lost count of the number of times he has said Americans have to choose between protecting the nation precisely the way he wants and not protecting it at all. On Friday, mm-hmm. Bush posed a choice between ignoring the law and wiretaps and simply not keeping tabs on terrorists. Then he said the United States could rewrite the Geneva Conventions or just stop questioning terrorists. To some degree, he's following a script for the elections, terrifying Americans into voting Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this listener out there in podcasting land, we've been saying this for 3 years. Bush, Blair, Bin Laden. Bush, Blair, Bin Laden. These three guys are on the same side of the same team. There are three peas in a pod.
Yeah, every time, you know, the polls go against Bush or the Senate actually goes against Bush, then he threatens the population with Bin Laden every single time. He says, I'm going to sick Bin Laden on you.
Yep.
So don't people have any sort, don't they make that connection at all? Don't they see that every time we're threatened by Bin Laden, it's because Bush has told them to?
They don't see it. It would seem obvious.
Yeah.
You know, they either give us, give me more power, or I'm going to send Bin Laden out there to kill you. And that's what's happened. That's what's been going on. It's so obvious from the very, very beginning. And we've been talking about it for 3 years. Now the New York Times is starting to get the connection. They're starting to see the pattern now. Every time Bush doesn't get his way, he sends Bin Laden out to commit terrorist acts. So the New York Times is now seeing the pattern. Now I think that the New York Times will probably soon understand that these three guys, Bush, Blair, and Bin Laden, are working together for power grabbing. And by then, I think it'll be too late, though.
You know, I bet we have tens of thousands of soldiers all over Afghanistan and Pakistan looking for Bin Laden. Where's the one place they're not going to look? And I bet you
the Rose Garden?
Yeah. I bet you he's hiding out in the White House. Can we start a conspiracy theory?
Well, he's obviously on the payroll somewhere. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that, you know, you can get a CCTV camera to be, you know, spying on some hoodie in a council flat in Nowheresville, London, and have a guy tracking it and know your GPS monitored a GPS tag or a radio frequency ID tag stuck to your razor blade that's being tracked by a computer. They know when you're shaving, how often you're shaving, when you're going to shave next, when they should send the cheap plastic shaver to the Walmart store in Arkansas to replace the shaver that they just had you shaving with and the time for you to buy the shaver. But they don't know where this guy is who's making these videos every few months. Now, obviously they don't because they're on the same team. Obviously, we've been saying it for 3 years. Now, the thing about the New York Times is that by the time, or maybe they already know it, but of course they sit on the stories, don't they? They knew about the NSA spying story before the election. They sat on the story. So the New York Times has no credibility, unfortunately, and they've, you know, they've aided and abetted a global murder spree.
Bush and Bin Laden. They've aided Bush and Bin Laden.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's their choice. So here, over there in the Financial Times, what do we got here? It says, declare war on torture. Congress must stop Bush from rewriting the Geneva Conventions. President George W. Bush says that what Congress does in the next 2 weeks could make or break the war on terrorism. He is right about that, but for all the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. The U.S. president insists that unless Congress creates kangaroo courts for terrorism detainees, authorizes him to spy on anyone he designates an enemy and rewrite key sections of the Geneva Conventions to legalize secret prisons and what he coyly calls alternative interrogation procedures, he will not have the tools he needs to win the war on terror. He hammered that message home again and again last week on the stump, on the hill, and even in a nationally televised address to mark the 5th anniversary of the insider trading scandal known as September 11. He even appears to have twisted the arm of some top military prosecutors, some of his most vocal critics up until now. Well, before I go on, let me just say this point.
Mm-hmm.
Last night we were having dinner with some American friends of ours.
Yeah.
And I noticed, I marked to myself, this was the first time in 5 years that I sat down with a group of Americans for a few hours. And not once during that entire time did 9/11 was 9/11 mentioned.
No. Well, these people are from San Francisco. I don't think they're a little bit more groovy than that.
Well, my point is, no, it's just that it's just the first time.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, because for the last 5 years, anytime I've sat down with a group of Americans, it's always been like, okay, at what point is 9/11 mentioned? Because 9/11 has become such an integral part to every single conversation for 5 years.
Exactly.
And
what happened to us earlier in the day when we went for a noisette? What did the French man say to us?
Oh, he said, where's Bin Laden? Where's Bin Laden? He talked about 9/11, basically.
Well, that was his introduction. He said, oh, are you two American? And we said, yes. And he said, where's Bin Laden? So obviously, this is the impression that Americans are giving out, that that's the only thing that they are about anymore.
Yeah. And so it's been impossible. It's just been, so this was the first time, actually, in 5 years that this wasn't mentioned. I mean, I guess it's significant to me just as a personal notation. You know, that this was the first time that you could actually spend 2 or 3 hours having a conversation without. Maybe it indicates that people are now beginning to understand the root causes of things a little bit more. Because we were talking about politics. So I think people are beginning to understand now that the 9/11 event was a symptomatic of a much bigger issue that involves guys like Bush. In what we're saying, that they are is part of this global power grab and passing debt on to the next generation, passing ecological devastation on to the next generation. This is part of this bigger plan to simply have the upper 1% of 1% secede.
Yeah, but ironically, Ground Zero is the only thing keeping the U.S. tourism afloat, because according to this latest news in the U.S., while global travel has grown by a fifth since 9/11, the U.S. travel industry's share of the world tourism market has shrunk by a third, from 9% of the world market to 6%. Mm-hmm. Tourism is booming all over the world, and we're not participating in it, says Jay Rasulu, chairman of Walt Disney Parks and Resorts.
Mm-hmm.
But Ground Zero has proved the exception. It is a potent international magnet. So ironically, this is what people are, this is all that America, it's the defining moment, really, in America already. Like, this is like that moment when the whole empire lost.
Oh, Bush is America's mortician.
Exactly. That's what you said a week ago.
He buried America. That's his role. That was his role. Thomas Jefferson and his crew invented it. Bush killed it. America, 1776 to 2000. Rest in peace.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what they go on in this article to ask. Is the question is why America is missing out. And according to Jeff Freeman, executive director of the Discover America Partnership, says, well, we're not a welcoming country. Most countries ask people to come visit them. We have more of a fortress appearance. And those are Bush's friends, the Casey, Titan, Halliburton, Bechtel, Blackwater. You know, he sold the country out to some military contractors. Of course, they're going to make you look like a fortress.
Right. Well, it's typical end-of-stage empire behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the people that can work to change this course of these events, like the white guys who are on welfare, you know, the biggest recipients of welfare are white men in America.
Exactly.
Not poor black mothers.
But that's what we were talking about earlier. That's that racism that, you know, it's constantly gets shouted that it's black single women that are collecting all this welfare. But in fact, the largest recipients are white men.
NASCAR dads. Yep. Sitting on their ass all day, drinking beer, getting a welfare check, refusing to do a goddamn thing to save themselves, their family, or their country. Then you've got the next generation who's basically getting out of school with intergenerational debt on their shoulder. There's no manufacturing. China now is starting to raise the wages for their workers. They're starting to move up the value-added food chain in services, so they are continuing to be the beneficiary of this incredible global wage arbitrage where China takes all the jobs and America takes all the debt. And, you know, it's what's the name of that country again?
America.
Oh, yeah. Whatever, America, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, you know, what do we got? Some elections. So, yeah, elections in the next 6 weeks, these November elections. I'm not hopeful that the Diebold voting machines and all the rest of that rigged market stuff is not going to succeed again in keeping the entrenched monopolists in power. And then you've got two more years of Bush, who is going to try to make the most of it by continuing down this path of, every time you don't let me change these laws, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to send bin Laden after you. He's going to terrorize that population into complete and utter subservience. And that's his plan. That's what he does. And this November election, they'll pull out all the stops to rig it. Obviously, in the markets, they're keen on keeping, let's say, the Dow Jones, I notice, is near an all-time high. It's very psychologically significant when you have the Dow Jones at an all-time high because it keeps up that dream alive of people striking it rich in America. The market's at an all-time high. The number of people who are benefiting from that has an all-time low, but, of course, that's not covered in the media, and those people who are really doing the rigging don't talk about it, and the people who are getting screwed are like the Katrina victims. You never hear about them until they're, you know, dead on the street, having been washed out by negligence and criminal negligence. So,
and plus, it takes now, in America, it takes $7 of debt to create $1 of GDP growth or $1 of a rise in the stock market.
So to get that market up to 10,000, 11,000, 12,000, you're going to create, the market's worth, what, $15 trillion? You're going to have to create $115 additional trillion dollars in debt to go on top of the $400 trillion in debt that exists right now.
Exactly. And that's why the debt bubble is so giant. It's because in order to create this fake illusion of the American dream.
And the Dow Jones going higher. The Dow Jones hitting a new high is going to take another $100 trillion in debt.
Mm-hmm. And who's going to inherit it? That's the question for you out there.
Well, the next generation, of course. Now, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, is having a big meeting with China. Karma Bank Research predicts that the outcome of this meeting will be a huge deal between America and China, where China takes control of something huge in the American economy, like Alaska, Hawaii, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, something huge in America. Maybe all three major car companies or the two that are owned by America. Something huge is going to be swapped to China in exchange for
restructuring of the peg of the Chinese currency to U.S. dollar. Hank Paulson's there doing it now.
But we won't find out until after the November elections. And then all those red states will be like, what?
Fing Chao Fing?
You're our new master.
Wong Chong Ching Chong Fing Fing Chong Chong. One from column A, two from column B. We want you trailer trash over here in this over here in this factory. You're not working for $50 a day? Yeah, November, mid-November. Hank Paulson's going to drop the bomb on America that several of the southern states have been sold to China. Which would be a good thing. I mean, you know, they'd be happy. They'd have no self-respect. Then, people on the East Coast will be happy to get rid of those Bible Belt fools. California will be happy.
Yeah, that's what our friends were talking about, too, is secession for California, Oregon, and Washington to just secede from the rest of the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, they've got the fifth biggest economy in the world already. They could easily do that, economically speaking, secede from the Union.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no benefit in keeping all 50 states or all these continental states together as it is now. There's not actually any benefit. There's a lot more benefits to, why does, so a guy like Sumner Redstone, right? He put CBS and Viacom together to create, and Paramount Pictures to create a conglomerate. Then he splits them apart. The Viacom separate, CBS is different, Paramount Pictures, part of this company. Then, of course, now the rumor is he's going to put them all back together again. So there's a tremendous advantage to conglomeration and deconglomeration. America went through a period of conglomeration, the westward expansion, the manifest destiny phase. Get all these states, get all continental America together. Well, there's probably a case we made to deconglomerate, to break up America into two or three or four bits and pieces for a while, have those pieces regenerate themselves and then reconglomerate them again. And it's like a breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. America has just been undermanaged, really. No one's really managing those assets at all in America, unfortunately. They're letting it slip through their fingers. So the youth is becoming uneducated. There's no broadband penetration. America's number 16 on the global broadband penetration list. So people are forced to buy DVDs at Walmart, where the rest of the world is just downloading movies and content for free. And they say, America is benefiting economically from Walmart. Well, they're forced to buy DVDs, whereas the rest of the world simply downloads plenty of good stuff for free. How is that economically better? Why is that better?
But they're also creating new economic models and participating in new economic models via the broadband internet, whereas those Americans, they're unable to.
No, there's a digital divide, and America's on the bad end of it.
Yeah.
America's on the bad end of the digital divide. They're not leading. They're not part of the countries. They're part of the have-not countries because of all the problems of Uber lobbyists in Washington who represent the copyright cartel, who are thwarting innovation. And, they got to keep Microsoft up there, even though Microsoft should have been out of business 20 years ago. It's got a crap product. Why should we subsidize Microsoft's crap products? Oh, because they own a piece of government? Oh, yeah, that's right, because it's not a democracy anymore, is it? It's communism. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's nice. So, yeah, George Soros was on TV saying something about communism and fascism in America, making the obvious point.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was some reaction against that.
Because he, of course, lived under Nazism. He did make the connection that there are very fascist tendencies in the Bush administration. And the person who was the journalist was saying, well, how can you dare say that? We're obviously nothing like Nazi Germany. But that's what George Soros said is like, well, yeah, not yet. But you don't want to wait until it's happening. You want to stop it before it becomes outright Nazi Germany-like.
Yeah, but I don't see how you can say it's not happening now. And the New York Times is saying that, Mr. Bush, every time you want us to abandon one of our civil rights, you threaten to kill us. How is that not fascist? You remember Hitler, Germany was a democracy before Hitler.
It was during him. They elected him. This is what the population elected.
Okay, and then he kept grabbing power.
Uh-huh.
And he kept saying, and he kept militarizing himself, and he said, either give me more power or I'm going to kill you. Mm-hmm. How is it different from Bush? I don't get it. Why is that at all different? Why is it not a why? When it, how can anyone debate this? It's a clear. It's like, you know, Godfather 1, Godfather 2, Hitler, Bush. This it's the same movie. What are you missing? Why did yeah? They, oh, I forgot. You have no education over there. That's right. You're high on donuts. I forgot. All right. Sorry. I don't mean to abuse you because you're stupid. So here in the Financial Times, it says a new way to protect capital in your portfolio. SG Hambros has developed a new approach to providing capital protection. So they developed a new approach to providing capital protection on an actively managed investment portfolio designed to overcome the drawbacks of existing structures. Investors get a 100% return of their capital at maturity, or 95% of the gains from a portfolio investing in a range of asset classes. The latter is a real innovation. The other techniques cannot guarantee consistent exposure to risk assets. With constant proportion portfolio insurance, the dominant structure for providing capital guarantees, there is the risk of monetization, where price movements cause the capital to be permanently moved to cash and no longer exposed to the underlying investment. There's no such risk with this particular product, which uses a volatility cap to manage exposure. The constraint on the basket of investments is that volatility must be no higher than 10%. The vol cap mechanism is not new, but has to date only been used systematically. So if you have a big spike in the volatility in year two, you lose exposure to the basket of investments at the beginning. Here we can change the basket on a monthly basis. So what does all this mean? What this means is that if you've got a portfolio of, let's say, $100 million in the stock market, you can, for 2 or 3% of that equity, insure your portfolio against any losses under any circumstances. On the same token, if the market goes up, you make money. So, for example, as we pointed out a second ago, the elections are coming up in November. The U.S. government, we know, buys securities and sells securities in the open marketplace to manage the price direction of indexes like the Dow Jones to give them their party in power a psychological and economic boost. The volatility is enhanced because the market's being artificially stimulated from outside forces that has nothing to do with the underlying supply and demand dynamics of what you would expect to be a free capitalist system. The volatility is something that people in the America are exposed to. Everyone who doesn't have a $100 million portfolio is exposed to volatility. Their house prices are going to go down. They're going to be whipsawed in the mortgage market. They're going to be whipsawed in the insurance market. They think they have insurance on their house, but they don't, as the people in New Orleans have found. People have money in the stock market. They get whipsawed. The market's up and down all over the place. When they have that experience, their risk, their principal is at risk. They are taking real risk. They're taking real capitalist risk. But once you have a $100 million portfolio, you go to your Pope banker over at Goldman Sachs or HSBC or Barclays or Citigroup, and you say, please, Pope, please anoint my portfolio with zero risk. And the Pope will say, give me a papal indulgence of 2% of the principal, and I will make it so that your portfolio has zero risk. Now, you can only make money. And that's not a society built on an economic system that evenly distributes risks and rewards. That is upward redistribution of wealth. That's trickle-up economics. That is stealing. That is a transference from a democratic society to a feudal society. And it's done using financial engineering and derivative products and volatility spreads. And it's happening right now. And it's being engineered right now. And unless you have $100 million, you're part of the permanent underclass in the world. And this is going to continue until, I believe, you're going to find a lot of conflict, I would say. A lot of conflict. There's going to be a lot of conflict out there.
Yeah. Plus, you know, when the government buys these securities on the open market, they're actually not doing it themselves. They're doing it via the banks. So it's the Goldman Sachs and the JP Morgans who are actually buying the securities for them. So certainly they know where the safe bets are for them and their favored clients for the next 6 weeks at least. Like what can't fail, what will not fail, because they're actually buying on behalf of the U.S. government, and therefore on behalf of the citizens of America, they're buying securities.
It's insider trading.
Exactly.
But one of the things the NSA spying program does is it gives the government, who are now in the business of buying and selling stocks, inside information as to who owns what.
Mm-hmm.
So they get a report every single day. As a stockbroker, you used to get a report every single day that showed all my clients, all their holdings, all the details about those holdings. So now the NSA is getting effectively the same thing. They get an account, all Americans, all citizens around the world, what they own, how long they've owned it, what the position is. And if they can then go into the market and buy and sell accordingly to scrape, to rake money for themselves and to add volatility and to disenfranchise and impoverish those who they don't feel are white enough to live.
Yeah, but this is just like, how do you, it's so surreal that the government does buy these securities in order to make the market go up and make the population feel that feel good factor in order to vote for the Republicans again. But they're buying securities with, they're creating money, which means they're creating debt and they're decimating your own savings of you, the U.S. citizen. So you're financing your own feel good factor. It's just that whole Norman Bates thing, I suppose. It always comes back to that, but that they are the ones, you know, you're looking at yourself in the mirror, your own finances, your own child's, your, you know, your debt, your future debt.
Well, the dot-com bubble was fake,
mm-hmm.
obviously,
mm-hmm.
and it blew up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there was democracy in the land, there would have been a pretty substantial recession,
mm-hmm.
and there would have been hell to pay.
Yeah.
And the politics who were behind that would have been thrown out of office, and Alan Greenspan would have been exposed as a charlatan. But we don't live in a democratic society, so what did happen is that the banks suddenly went into overdrive, offering interest-only loans, loans where you can skip a payment, all these mortgage derivatives and mortgage mutations to avert any accountability for the dot-com bubble, to avert any accountability for the Federal Reserve irresponsibility, to move trillions of dollars quickly into creating a new bubble, which is the real estate bubble. Now, many people lost their shirts on the dot-com explosion. They will never recover. It created a huge wealth confiscation. People who did survive went whole hog into real estate speculation. That global bubble in real estate market has now reached its end point. You cannot grow trees to the sky, as the old saying goes.
I've never heard of it.
It's an old Wall Street saying that trees don't grow to the sky.
Trees don't grow to the sky.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
It means that if you're buying Akamai Technologies at $300 a share, it doesn't mean it's going to go to $1,000 a share.
Uh-huh.
There are physical limitations to everything.
Yeah.
And trees, although they're growing, they don't grow forever. They don't keep growing to the sky.
Yeah.
And, of course, Akamai Technologies went from $300 a share to 70 cents a share. There are many, many people who suffered economic problems with that. So now you've got this real estate bubble that was engineered using these just these types of products that I just mentioned. Bankers figuring out, well, the banks will offer interest-only loans where people don't even own anything. They're just paying interest. So now you've got this huge, huge bubble. The bubble in the real estate market is collapsing. There's going to be an effort to direct that collapsing cash, I think, back into the stock market to glide the path of this next November elections. But there will be millions and millions of people who will be put into the gutter as a result of this real estate collapse. And the point of all this is that the markets have been co-opted by a corrupt political process. They no longer function in any way, shape, or form, as an economic adjunct. They're a purely a political tool at this point, with the Diebold voting machines, the market rigging, the vote rigging, the plunge protection team, the working group in Washington. The markets are now completely just another tool for the political process, like gerrymandering, like political advertising, like political action committees. It's just markets have become now completely dominated by political wonks who can pull the levers, push buttons, and make markets go whichever way they think will be politically expedient Now, that is communism. That's communism. When you've got the Politburo, who fix prices for political outcomes and for handing out pork, for handing out subsidies, for handing out favors to give in exchange for money to rig elections.
And they help their compatriots, the insiders, like Long-Term Capital Management or Kirk Kerkorian. If they place a big bet and lose on these, even though the markets are still are rigged, they still lose. Well, then they rig the market even more to protect these guys from falling out of the feudal class.
That's right. Long-Term Capital Management. They let the entire Asian financial collapse occur, and the lowering interest rates in America to the detriment of millions of retirees to help a few guys in Greenwich, Connecticut make their yacht payments. That's not democracy. That's not even close to being a democracy. That's not even close. Well, all right then, honey bunny, that's it for today. Time to go. Go in now. See you tomorrow. We're going down to the store to buy some of that nice cheese. Oh, you got to listen to Coca-Cola song. Got to listen to the Coca-Cola song on our Karma Bank Radio, the put together by Fair Trade Trousers.
Oh, yeah, it's great. We have it on our website, karmabankradio.com. Check it out.
Fair Trade Trousers. Fair Trade Trousers has got his hit single, Mary Mary. Right now, KarmaBankRadio.com is a fantastic anti-Coca-Cola song. The man is a pure musical genius. You got to check it out. Fair Trade Trousers.